Good morning. பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் ஸ்ரீ அன்னை தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைவ் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் துவங்க இருக்கிறது. அன்பர்கள் அனைவரையும் இதில் பங்கு கொண்டு அன்னையின் அருளை பெறுமாறு தாழ்மையுடன் வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம். Now I am inviting Mr. Gary Tekas.
He says what's there in the plant and the animal is actually there in all material substance. It's even there in the stone. Only thing is, we can't sense it. If we have any engineers here, they have a phenomenon called metal fatigue, where if you use a metal over and over again, it becomes weak, as if it's getting old or tired. Metal fatigue. He says this is an expression, Shrimindo says, this is an expression in the metal of what we call fatigue or exhaustion at higher levels of life. Other things are there, but we can't see them on the surface. We haven't learned how to detect them yet. But essentially, they're all alive. He gives another argument. He says, we know that life, just because a person is sleeping, doesn't mean there's no life. They may be still. They may not respond when we call them. Some people sleep very soundly. Even if you shout at them, they don't respond. I've seen a person, even if you kick them, they don't respond. But it doesn't mean they're not alive. It means their consciousness is within drawn. So it's not there on the surface. He says even after death, for a significant period after death, when it looks like the body is dead, when medical science has pronounced it dead, it's still possible for the life to come back. Because the life is still there. It's just not showing itself on the surface. It's not showing in the breathing. It's not showing in the respiration or circulation. In fact, Mother in Agenda tells the story about a boy who was a man who was pronounced dead, and all the medical doctors said he's dead, and they buried him. And in the middle of the night, the father had a dream that the boy was calling to him and saying, "Why have you buried me?" And the father was so superstitious about it. Later, they went and they opened the tomb and saw the boy has turned over. Actually, he wasn't dead, though. From all medical purposes, he had been dead for quite some time, but life could still come back. Extreme cases, but it shows the principle. That's true in deep trance. You can go into, a yogi can go into a trance so deeply that he seems to be completely unresponsive on the surface, but the consciousness is inside. That's what the stone is. The consciousness is so buried inside that we don't see it on the surface. It doesn't mean there's no life or consciousness in the stone. So now he says, what we call life, is the bridge between mind and matter. Life is the energy connection. When I hit my leg, life is the sensation that carries a message to my mind to tell me, be careful, there's something here that's hurting the body. When I sink, then it means I should stretch my leg out or avoid that spot. My thought has to be translated and make matter respond. Life is the force to translate my thought into action. Otherwise, we'd have thoughts here and matter there and no connection. Matter is the link between intention, between our conscious intention and material substance. It's an intermediate stage. matter we see looks to be inconscient, we feel and pride ourselves on being conscious. Life is the subconscious link in between, but in fact, it's three levels of the same thing. So, as I've been saying, life is there in matter. That's why life can come out of matter. And all life liberates vibrations of sensation and reaction, which is the creative force working in matter. Because Mother has spoken so much and Appa has written so much about flowers, we know that each flower, Mother says, has its own spiritual vibrations. Spiritual vibration is not a material thing. Spiritual vibration is a vibration of consciousness. If I can hold a flower and feel peaceful or cheerful, it's because there, that consciousness is there in the flower that can directly translate into my consciousness. Because there is a consciousness in the plant. Otherwise, it could not have those qualities. Mother is able to accentuate that consciousness. When we offer the life energy flower to Mother, or the prosperity, she multiplies that vibration because the plant is physical. We are physical. We are more receptive to something physical than something that's immaterial. So when I hold the life energy flower, Mother's consciousness can come more through that flower because it's a material thing with that vibration of energy.
So why do you not have the idea
that
you're
consciousness of that flower? Because we're half conscious. That's what we mean by half conscious. If we were fully conscious, we wouldn't need any flower because Mother's everywhere, everything is Satchitananda. You don't need, everything is energy. We won't need any flower to, you can give the life energy to the flower. Because we are unconscious, because we are more physical than we are spiritual, because that's how we've evolved. Then it'll come to the question why we use medicines, which is what I want to discuss a little later. Why the body can respond to medicine. Mind can have faith in Mother. Still, for many people, the medicine, the physical medicine has a role because we're physical. And therefore, the physical vibration, you can talk to me about food all day long, but if I haven't eaten for 24 hours, it doesn't quench my appetite. I may have the knowledge of it, but I'm not able to yet translate that down. Whereas Sri Aurobindo says, if I'm super mentalized, I won't need this silly habit of eating all the time in order to get energy. After all, I'm eating to get energy. I can direct the energy I take from material substance, I can directly take from the atmosphere, because the whole world is full of energy, because I'm still physical. Why do we eat? The things we eat are all living things. They may not still be alive, but they're all, we don't eat sand and clay. It has no value for us. The only thing that can give us nutritional value is something that was alive. Because in creating that life form, energy has been captured in that rice or vegetable, whatever it is. And when we consume it, we extract the energy from it. It shouldn't be necessary for us. The question you've rightly asked, we can ask about why are we eating? When the whole of life is a universal force, why should we need food to get our energy? We should be able to directly take it from each other or directly take it from, which is true. And in fact, Sri Aurobindo did a fast for, I think, 21 or 22 days. And for 22 days, he said there was absolutely no reduction in his energy level. That means he was taking energy directly from the universe during that time. But he said even for him, the physical body was depleted. The physical substance was depleted. He could restore the life energy. He couldn't replace the physical substance of the body. So that's because we're imperfect. That's for the future. It's a good question. Many examples like that of how material objects show their consciousness. One of the most dramatic, you all must have that experience. Why is cleaning powerful? We have all seen, I think, the power of cleaning to attract prosperity, to attract harmony, to improve health, because when you clean, you are giving attention to the consciousness in the material things and bringing out their higher consciousness. And there are so many examples the devotees have had. I know one of the stories Janani told me from one of the meetings at the centers, I don't remember which center was, a devotee who had lost important certificates, and she decided to clean her house. And certificates thoroughly, and certificates that had been missing for more than a year came back. Lost keys. One devotee was praying for months for rain, and then read Appa's book on rain, and finally decided to clean her own water tank. And the night she cleaned her own water tank, there was huge rain and the water table rose by 10 feet. She had been praying, she had read, but the physical act of giving attention to the water actually brought the response. Why? Because we're physical in our consciousness. Because we need to do the physical thing to fully express it. There was a Japanese man who did some fantastic experiments to show that even water is conscious. Even water is conscious. This picture, the detail, the titles are not there, but the two pictures are at a very small microscopic level of what the water droplet looks like. And the picture on the left was when the photographer, whether the scientist, had very bad feelings towards the water. And on the right was when he projected feelings of love towards the water. And this is only one photo, but he has hundreds of photos showing different things and how, it's fantastic to see. If I hadn't known the theory, I would have really questioned the practice, but this is fully in conformity with what Sri Aurobindo has told us. So even water is conscious. Water responds to our moods, our attention. When we're angry that there's no water, or we're angry that there's too much water, that's also, we all know that, or the water is there in the streets flooding everything, the water also responds to our feelings. Attention to water, Appa wrote in his first book, that story about the man who lost his wallet in Mexico and was driving back and forth trying to find it on the road, and finally he just sat down and he didn't know where he had left it. He had stopped so many places along the way. Finally he just stopped the car and sat down, and he remembered that Appa had talked to him about mother. He's not even a devotee. He prayed to mother and he opened his eyes and he saw the wallets there on the bush. I always wondered about that story. So mother may be powerful, but he has gone and stopped some 10 places along the road in this 200 miles. How was it he was back right at that place? Appa's argument was he didn't stop at the right place. The wallet came to where he was. The wallet responded to his prayer. Ranjani had a wonderful experience. I don't know if she's told any of you. A few years ago, she left her cell phone out on the in front of her house, and somebody stole it within 5 minutes. And because she knew the code number, they were able to trace that somebody was using the phone in Trichy or Madurai or something like that. And after some more time, they found she was, I had talked to her about consecrating it and the phone can come back. After some more time, they found out that the person who's using it is in Pondicherry. And they recontacted and got the phone back. The phone came back to her. There's one of the devotees told a story of her husband who used to leave his watch everywhere and neglect it. And finally, maybe because of his wife's complaints or what, he decided that he would carefully keep his watch in one place all the time. And within a short period of time, he was gifted 4 more watches. Material things respond to attention. Abba has written in his first book about when you use things to the maximum utilization, they come. He told the story of cement. I think most of you know that story. I was remembering that story, and a few months ago we were working with Venkatesan, and he was having severe power cut at his factory. So we said, why don't you try maximum utilization of power, which Shapa had also done at the garden. So he agreed, and he told his factory manager they were having 4 or 6 hours of power cut every day, and they only had power 5 days out of the 7. And so they started, whenever the power comes, immediately they should turn on all the machines without wasting a minute. First, they brought it down to within 15 minutes, the machines were turned on, then 10 minutes, then they brought it down to 2 minutes. The day we visited the factory, there was no power cut. Within about 10 days, the 2-day power cut a week was eliminated as well. Because of that effort at maximum utilization, not only for him, it was eliminated throughout the state.
But when she entered in the car, she was a hot feeling. She had some disturbance and she was talking about that. And it was told, noon we are traveling. The AC is there, but if the AC is running, it's too hot. Then I asked his driver, why the AC is not working? He said, it is working. After I asked him to turn up the AC, and we opened the window. After that, it is very hot. And she was talking about the problem with some hot talk. And we went to the shop and finished everything, and we came to the center. And immediately it was Venkatesan's car. I called him because you have to check up with the AC in the car, because the car is how the car is maintained and the driver is new. And immediately he took the action. And he said, because the car has come day before yesterday after the service. And when they turn on the AC, it is perfectly working. It is very good. The AC is perfectly working. But the driver put on the hot suit, the other suit. So we are hot in our form. It is not form, it is so noon, it is cold. But he called me that AC is perfectly alright. The driver had a mistake. Then we understood that driver had no mistake. Our attitudes and our thoughts.
Use the mic so others can hear.
My friend came to see me. He's working in Dubai. So his flight was at 4 o'clock, so he came to meet me at 9:30 by the time I reached my home. And, you know, we had spent 1 hour, and then I wanted to drop him at his home. We came out, I took my scooter. I told my friend that I'm planning to change the scooter. We plan to get a new scooter. So we got into the scooter. I took him around, say, 1.5 kilometers. It suddenly stopped without any reason. And it was around 11:30, 11:45. Then I did not know any reason why it stopped. I tried several times. I kicked it off. And my friend was waiting for it. He had to move for the airport. And then I asked him to take an auto and move off from there. It took more than 2 kilometers to, roll the scooter, down home. Then I thank God, probably, life has responded to me. Probably, I have told my friend that I am selling his scooter off. Probably, it didn't like. I am very conscious that I am going to attend the last 2 days on the line. So, something that I should not have done.
I recall Ashoka's of stories of when he thought of selling his scooter, how it protested on him. It's a good example. Yes.
The same example of car. I used to give maximum attention to my car. I think that even the least problem is resolved immediately. One fine day when we started from home, I used to drop my son at school. The minute I came down the downstairs, the car started giving an anti-theft alarm. I thought probably it was a cat, but immediately I called my mother and I said that I don't know what it is telling me. You have to take care, because and that knowledge has been purely given by the central discussion and APA's knowledge and these types of discussion. It already goes to that. So when I got in the car, again I concentrated and then we started and I said, I don't know why the alert is coming because and it has to take care of my mother. We went to the school, I just parked the car was stopped, literally stopped. My son, the minute he got down, the car started rolling without my knowledge, and his leg was in the tire, so ankle was in the tire.
I saw a man
who was other side of the road. I don't know how he came immediately, just pulled the car with his hand. The engine is on, and my son is telling my leg is caught in the, but I don't know what to do.
I'm very sorry to interrupt.
Yes, Ranjani?
Echo, sir. You're not able to hear anything.
Because it's echoing?
Yes.
Mute. 1 second.
Yeah, I do not know what to do because if I roll the car in the front, my son's leg will get more hurt, and if I reverse it, I don't know whether the leg will come out. I had all my knowledge, everything was jot down to zero, and only consecration was to mother. I just put the reverse gear and pulled it on, and his leg came out. This was a very experience which the car had alerted me right before starting. So and to change that atmosphere, sir, I had to put on the DVD with the Om Namah Bhagavate cassettes to change the atmosphere, so that again I concentrated that there's nothing happens in future do that. And this was 6 months before. After 3 months, I was in the plan of changing my car. Then what I did was, because it was giving me some problem in the ACs, and also the service, the person who does the service said that it's better to change because it's 5 years old. So I called up the agent and he came, and I was it was a sunny day. He just started the car. I was in the shadow. Even I cannot forget the feeling that, I saw it was like a small kid coming and cuddling me and telling, please don't give me, I'll be with you and serve you better. So I don't know whether this is my feelings because of the attachment to the car, or it is the attention that which has given life to the car. Thank you, sir.
We don't think of changing our children when they give us trouble, or our bodies when it gives us trouble. But we do think of changing our cars and our cell phones so that we can quite pay attention. And our toothbrushes.
So the
gratification
that
got attached to
that,
was it
physical attachment that
I had to the car, or it was the life, I mean, the matter that has? No, car has a consciousness, definitely. Of course, if you're more attached to it, you relate to it more. Somebody who doesn't relate to the things is completely in. But the person who's completely indifferent to material things and treats them just like that, they will also respond like that. They'll break down quickly. But the person who has not the attachment is lower. If you have a higher attitude towards the material thing, it will serve you much, much longer. Things never wore out for mother. Even the broom would go on and on for years. Because she related to it in a higher way. Perfectly true. There are gradations of sure, you can, definitely. These are my response. So, objects carry a consciousness. Objects also carry a consciousness of their owner. Many years ago, somebody gave up a book. And when he was reading the book, he kept seeing a picture, an image, a vision of another man, a devotee who had passed away, an ashramite who had passed away. He mentioned to the man who had given the book, every time I read, it was synthesis, I think. Every time I read this book, no, it was a book on the Veda. Every time I read this book, I keep seeing an image of that man. He says, yes, it was his book. Appa could see the subtle thing. Everything carries not only its own consciousness, the consciousness, food carries the consciousness of the person who prepares it. Objects carry the consciousness of the person who has owned them and given them. So everything has that consciousness in it. Physical nature responds. The devotees have seen that rain responds when we seriously call it. Dion made the lightning respond. Mother's story, I think you all know, of how when they were trying to build a seawall in Pondicherry where the park guest house was, the sea kept coming in. And mother went out there and put her chair on the beach, and she spoke to the sea god. And the sea stopped coming in, and they built the wall, and the building is still there. Janani reported from one of her meetings, the devotee said she had planted and raised some hibiscus flowers in her flats, near her flats, but other people in the flat kept going and picking all of the hibiscus flowers, and she was very furious. Somebody advised her, instead of being attached to the flowers, you take an attitude of self-giving towards the flowers. And she found out within a short period of time, somebody, the owners of the building, I don't know the details, planted a few hundred hibiscus flowers all around the flat. And there was enough hibiscus flowers for everybody, and more than enough, because she changed her attitude. Now we come to a very interesting thing, is what is the implications of this for us practically in the most material part of our life, which is health? There are a number of practical things we can take away from this. One is that Mother says, if you give attention to your mind, it gets confused. If you give attention to your vital, it gets depressed. If you give attention to your body, it gets ill. Of course, attention means you worry about it. If you become preoccupied with yourself, mother tells this story about a French lady who was living in the ashram decades ago. She was very depressed. She was living alone, an elderly lady. She was very depressed. She asked mother for some advice. Mother said, you climb out the window from your ground floor apartment with some grapes in your hand and walk down the middle of the street eating grapes. As a cure for depression. Because this lady was withdrawing from everybody, thinking she's very important, very superior, very proper. Her withdrawal and self-preoccupation, it created a depression. So do something absolutely ridiculous that shows your laughing stock. You'll lose your depression. So being preoccupied with the health of the body, in the medicine they call it hypochondria, is enough to make even the healthy body sick. So mother's advice is forget your health. Forget your body. That doesn't mean neglect it. That doesn't mean do the opposite of what you should do. But don't be preoccupied with fear of illness. Even the medical science finds that a very large percentage of disorders can be traced back to psychological conditions. Mother says it's not a large percentage. It may be 99%. There may be a small percentage, a very small number that aren't. So that means if you really want to manage your health, managing your consciousness is more important. What we think and what we feel is more important for our health. The body responds to our feelings and our thoughts. When we live full of tension, anger, frustration, resentment, it creates a disorganization and illness in the body. When we compete with others, when our life is full of strife, it translates into illness in the body. When we know this principle and we focus on changing our attitude, the body responds to that. We can call mother to replace tension, conflict, and resentment with peace, harmony, and so forth as a way to, the animals tend to live fairly healthy lives. They don't have all the symptoms and complaints that we do. Without having the conscious mind, they're not always worried. Is my daughter going to get a good marriage? Does my sari look very good today? Is my car is old and my neighbor's got a new car? That person's got a new watch. The animals are freed from all of these silly preoccupations which cause disturbances for us. So mother says illness is the result of a disequilibrium, a loss of harmony that translates in the body as disorder, disharmony, disorganization. We're not animals without these thoughts, but our thoughts are not very human, actually. Maybe the animal's better in this regard than we are. Mother marveled at the way Sri Aurobindo could remove a disease simply by the wave of his hand. Maybe he didn't even have to wave his hand. It's only a figure. Because disease is a disharmonious vibration. When you think of mother, when you call mother, when you embrace mother, the vibration of disease and disharmony disappears. Whenever we're agitated, nervous, accidents come when we're nervous or agitated. Being always calm. Mother says we have a nervous envelope. And when that's agitated, we become vulnerable. If that's strong and calm and filled with her consciousness, we'll be always protected. She tells that story when she was young, I think 19 or 20, she was meditating and walking down the street in Paris, and without looking where she was going, she went out into the street, and suddenly she was knocked back onto the sidewalk. And just then a streetcar went by very rapidly. The streetcar never hit her. It touched her, the subtle envelope of her body, which protected her. She never saw the streetcar. It never hit her body. It touched her atmosphere, and her body was protected. That's how Mother will protect us when we stay in her consciousness, when we keep conscious of her. The body responds very much to suggestions. If we're afraid of something, if we think that there's a disease, if we think we may catch something, it's like an open invitation to us. I had this personal example, which if it didn't happen to me, I don't think I would have believed it. But my close friend Bob had gone on an international trip with an Indian scientist, an older man who had back problems. And when they got to Singapore, that man was complaining a lot of back problem, and Bob, who had no health problem at all, woke up the next morning with severe back pain. It was so powerful that he couldn't get out of the bed. He had to sit in a hot tub for a few hours. He came back to India 2 days later, and we went on a trip. He told me this story, and we went on a trip together up into, we had to go on a business trip, we went up into Uti. And I got out of the car, and suddenly I had severe back pain that was so bad I had to cancel the trip. We went to Coimbatore to fly back to Madras and go to a hospital. And then, this is a very serious case, the doctor said, this has been developing for quite some time, and you'll be permanently disabled by this. Maybe you'll have to have surgery. You know, how could this happen? And then I've got a back pain. He doesn't have any history of back pain. He comes back, and suddenly I get back pain. But my mind told me, see, my father always suffered from back pain. For 20 years he suffered from back pain until he came to family, meditated with Bob's mother, and the back pain was relief. So I inherited it from my father. It took me 4 years to give up the belief that I had a serious back pain problem. In spite of all that I know, in spite of it was a contagious vibration. And it took me 4 years to convince myself that this is a silly superstition. And the doctor who shows me the x-ray proving that I'm permanently disabled, it's a superstition. My body is simply behaving my belief, accepting my belief and acting accordingly. It's acting sick. After that, the pain disappears. So disease is contagious in the sense it's contagious to suggestion, what we believe. That's why our faith is so important. That's why our conviction and understanding is so important. I think in an earlier meeting I had told examples of the placebo effect. Maybe I don't remember which one it was, but I'll repeat a couple of them. I don't know if any of you know poison ivy. I don't think it's here. It's a certain green leaf with a poisonous substance on it, and if you get it on your skin, it creates a rash. And there are some people, where we grew up, it was very common. And there are some people who are particularly susceptible to this. And if you rub it, it goes anywhere on the body. It spreads. Wherever the chemical spreads, it creates a rash. And so in Japan they did a study. They took some people with severe poison ivy allergy, and they rubbed poison ivy on one arm and told them this is a herb, a good herb for healing. And they rubbed an ordinary leaf on the other arm and said this is poison ivy. And the arm where they said was an herb, which was really poison ivy, I think they had some 14 participants, only one of them got the rash. And on the arm where they said it was poison ivy and that we wasn't, about 12 of them got the rash. Then there is the very famous story of Mr. Rabbit, which actually comes from New York Times or Wall Street Journal. We have the article. It was published in the 30 years ago. A man who developed real cancer in the stomach and was given up for a big tumor in the stomach and was given up that he won't have more than a week or two to live. There was no, it was too late to do anything about it. Mr. Wright read that there was some cure for this. And he asked the doctor, please, before he dies, at least you can try this cure. The doctor knew that the cure doesn't work. He gave the drug to Mr. Wright, and within a day or two, the tumor completely disappeared. No study had proven that this drug works, but his tumor, the doctor had never seen anything like this, and they documented it. And Mr. Wright was discharged, completely healthy, went home free. And then about a month later, he came back and the tumor was completely regrown. The doctor was baffled. He'd never heard of anything like this. It's impossible. It's a medical impossibility. He asked Mr. Wright what happened. He said, oh, I was doing some research and I found out that this drug doesn't really cure cancer. The moment he changed his understanding of the drug, the tumor came back. Then the doctor understood something really incredible is happening here. So he went back and he told the patient, said, what you learned was correct. That version of the drug doesn't get permanent cure, but there's a new version of the drug, which was only water or something like that, which is sure gives a full cure. And so he gave him that one, and again the tumor completely disappeared. And after a few months he came back and again the tumor was there and the doctor said, what happened? No, I did far research and I found out that even that checked. So the body is responding to our faith to that extent, and it's been dramatically shown. Which also means if we don't interfere, if we don't fill our body full of superstitions and fears and contagions and all, the body will cure itself. Mother says when the body is given the conditions that it believes are necessary for its cure, and if the body has faith, it doesn't need any conditions, it will set itself right. It doesn't need operation, it doesn't need drugs. But the body responds to our faith and our aspirations. In the U.S., they did a study and they said that 85% of doctors in the U.S. found that people who have a religious or spiritual faith have better health. That's a huge, that's their experience. I think they found that the heart patients who have a strong religious faith are three times more likely to survive than those that don't. And that's an ordinary faith. That's not a supramental faith. Then that story of Morris Goodman, which I think has been told earlier, a man who was flying a plane. He was a salesman. He was flying his own plane. It crashed. He was completely paralyzed. He couldn't talk. He couldn't breathe on his own. His bones, all the bones were broken. Cervical bones, all the way through his body. The doctor said that within a week, he told the family, within a week he'll be dead. There's no cure, there's no surgery, nothing. And the man couldn't talk, So he signaled to his sister through his eyes. They created a language where he could blink his eyes to communicate. And he sent word to the doctor that within 12 months he plans to walk out of the hospital. He was a deeply religious man. And he did. You can see his videos on the internet. Been 12 months from something that was a known impossibility, which shows the body will respond to our faith. The body can respond to our aspiration. So, conclusions. One is, best way to outer health is inner harmony. Every thought, every feeling matters. We can't always control our thoughts and feelings, but we can always try to remember to call Mother and consecrate them to Mother and ask her to dissolve the disharmonies that naturally arise. Appa has written about the complete act. He said, any act to be complete needs three things. The clear mental understanding and the mental decision, the vital enthusiasm, and the full participation of the body. So we now understand that mental thought, vital energy, and material substance are three forms of the same thing. The goal of the integral yoga is the body should become divine. So transforming our thoughts and our feelings is the step before expressing that at the level of our physical level. To do any act perfectly, to do any act completely, starts not with what we do physically, starts with what we understand and what we feel about it. And giving the full emotional consent to it. I've had many people ask me about consecration. Consecration is most powerful, not when we think about Mother, I offer this to you, but when our emotions fully consent, endorse, what we are thinking. Then it has the power of life to fulfill itself. I think we've gone to the full limit, but if there's any question, we can take it before we ask Chandrasekhar to speak.
Ashok?
Somewhere along your speech, you said that there is really no evil, and all that happens to us are only attempts by life to awaken our consciousness. Are you listening? Hello?
Yes, Ashok.
I was just wondering.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
The elopement of Lydia was a great ordeal for the Bennett family. Unfortunately, they came out of that ordeal with the better results than they expected. Now, let us say that Lydia never eloped. That the ordeal of Lydia eloping didn't at all happen in the Bennett family. How would you visualize the story would have ended, supposing the girl didn't elope? Do you still think Darcy would have proposed to Lizzie, and Lizzie would have said yes, and Bingley would have gone ahead proposing to Jane? I'm just wondering, what will be the outcome in the event of Lydia not eloping? Will it be the same as when the girl eloped, whether the family would have still achieved as good results without the elopement as was the case when she eloped? If it is true that the RDL.
I understand the question, Ashok. It's an excellent question. I think there was a profound progress that both Lizzie and Darcy could make. They were ready to get married when they met at Pemberley. But if they had gotten married at Pemberley, it would not have been the real romance, a lot of the progress they made, they would never have made. From Darcy's point of view, he had accepted what she said and the abuse. He had seen the truth in her abuse when she abused him at Hunsford. But he had never had a chance to demonstrate to her how seriously he had corrected himself. He needed to express physically what he had decided mentally. If I'm a selfish man, I may decide that I will become unselfish. But there's a big difference between deciding I'd be unselfish and actually giving everything away and feeling the joy in giving when I've only felt the joy in taking. So Lydia's elopement gave Darcy an opportunity to physically demonstrate, not only to her, but to himself, that he has really changed. He was, as Lizzie said, by going to London, seeking out this dastardly man, Wickham, he disliked so much, this girl whose behavior was so vulgar and inappropriate. He could show how much he really loved Lizzie. He could show to what extent he has overcome his class consciousness. Lizzie said to him later, she can't imagine how mortifying it was for him. She uses the word mortification. How mortifying it was for you to go to London and do these things. And he presided over the marriage. He spent an enormous amount of money, maybe a whole year's income, on this scoundrel and this silly girl. Not only to demonstrate to her, because he didn't intend that she should even know about it, but to really change in the substance of his body what he had changed in his consciousness. That opportunity he would not have had if it wasn't for Lydia's elopement. From Lizzie's side, she had understood the truth about Wickham when she read Darcy's letter at Hunsford. She had understood the truth about her own family when she read the letter. But she understood it with her mind, not fully with her vital and her emotions. Because after that, when she went home and advised her father not to send Lydia to Brighton, she refused to disclose what she knew about Wickham. She still wanted to protect him. She still felt a soft corner for him. She was still charmed by his falsehood. And because of that, the family was vulnerable and the elopement could come. So she had an opportunity to really change at the vital level, to fully recognize the impurities in her family consciousness, the attraction that she felt to falsehood, to really regret it and reverse it. When she regretted it and reversed it at the physical level, in the depths of her subconscious, the whole thing was set right. So, yes, I think there could have been a marriage, even a successful marriage, but there could not have been the phenomenal progress that Darcy made, and Darcy could never have reached those heights of joyous fulfillment, romantic fulfillment, if it hadn't been for the elopement. So, very good question.
So, I
For all I know, people like to minimize problems of any type from entering their life.
Yeah.
Looks like you are openly saying we should invite RDLs of all kinds to enter into our life. Is that that your intention?
Ashok said, for all he knows, we would all like to minimize ordeals in his life, in our lives. It sounds like, am I saying that we should invite ordeals in our life? Mother has said, don't invite trouble. Life will give us enough challenges without our inviting it. That's different than saying that when problems come to us, we should recognize that problems are opportunities. We don't have to ask for trouble, but when the troubles come, we should understand they come for a purpose. And the right thing for us is to make the maximum progress we can in those difficulties, because there's something for us to learn. There's progress for us to make, otherwise it won't come.
I think, was there another question here?
We have one more question here, and then I think we should go on to Chandru's presentation.
The difference between life and life force, sir. Can you please explain the difference between life and life force? Life and life force, difference. So not in particular, because you said even when the body, you know, dies, still life is there in that context.
Everything depends on where what we're talking about, because essentially Sri Aurobindo says life is a force. What we call life is not a thing. We think of life as a thing. Oh, he was alive, now he's not alive. That's the way we use the word, because we don't understand what it is. What we really should say is the life force was in the body and now the life force is leaving the body. There is only one life. It's a universal life. That universal life, it's like electricity. Is there electricity for the microphone, for the computer, for the light bulb or not? We don't say the light bulb is dead. We say the switch is off, but the current is not there. The light doesn't give life by itself. It's the force of electricity that converts and shows as life. When the bulb is broken, the electricity may be there, but we don't get life. Because the form, the organization of the bulb, is not capable of expressing the electricity as life. Life is the electricity. The body is the bulb. If the bulb gets broken beyond a certain level, it can show that the electricity is there. The electricity is still there. If the electricity is not there, no matter how you fix the bulb, it's not going to shine. Life is a universal force, just like electricity is a universal force. It builds up and animates forms, and when those forms are no longer useful, when they're broken or when they limit, he's going to tell us in the next chapter, he's going to tell us that life, that death is an essential part of life. I have skipped it in this one because it comes in the next chapter in a bigger way. He does discuss it here. I thought we could take it up next time. But he calls death a process of life. So essentially, life, to understand life properly, we should understand it as a universal life force. In a practical way, we say that man is or person is no longer alive. It means something to us. We don't say the universal life force has left the body of that particular man, but that is really what we mean. Yes, the force that decomposes the body is the same force that grew the body, that built up the body. I didn't want to go into it because we're going to take it next month fully, a long description of it, but that's it. It's the same force that builds the muscle. Huh? Same force. There's only one. it's a very fascinating thing. We've just 4 chapters on life. This is only the first one. This is only the material basis of life. But there's a lot more he's going to tell us. Okay?